God's only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. On today's program, we start with Art and Discipline of Nonviolence. Congressman John Lewis talks about the civil rights movement and the part he played in it. He also talks with Krista Tippett about how to apply nonviolence today. And then after that, mental health expert Dr. Lloyd Sedeter talks with Tavis Smiley about the mental health crisis in the U.S.
The movement created what I like to call a nonviolent revolution. It was love at its best. It's one of the highest forms of love. That you beat me, you arrest me, you take me to jail, you almost kill me. But in spite of that, I'm going to still love you.
John Lewis is a United States congressman, and he was a core leader, one of the big six of the civil rights movement. I had the honor just a few weeks ago to be part of a congressional civil rights pilgrimage led by this man and attended by 30 members of the House and Senate from both parties. We stood on holy ground of the movement in Tuscaloosa, Birmingham, Montgomery, Selma. It was a journey into history I thought I knew, but didn't really. Into the civil rights leaders' spiritual confrontation within themselves, and into their intricate art and work of successful nonviolence. Leave me alone. This is Betty Mae Fike's leading song on the pilgrimage, a half century after she was a teenaged freedom singer of the civil rights movement. I'm Krista Tippett. This is On Being from APM, American Public Media. I sat with Congressman John Lewis in Montgomery, Alabama. I'd like to start by talking about faith, which is a bedrock of your life. It's one of the bedrocks that you name prominently in your most recent book. And I'd like to just hear a little bit about how you would describe the foundation of faith, the spiritual background of your childhood.
I grew up in rural Alabama, about 50 miles from Montgomery, outside of a little place called Troy. My father was a sharecropper, a tenant farmer. But back in 1944, when I was 4 years old, and I do remember when I was four, my father had saved $300, and with the $300, he bought 110 acres of land. We grew up very, very poor. Six brothers, three sisters, wonderful mother, wonderful father, wonderful grandparents. But growing up as a child, I saw segregation and racial discrimination, and I didn't like it. And I would ask my mother, my father, my grandparents, my great-grandparents why. They would say, that's the way it is. Don't get in the way. Don't get in trouble. But attending church and Sunday school, reading the Bible, the teaching of the great teacher, and being deeply influenced by what I saw all around me, it was this belief that somehow, in some way, things were going to get better, that you had to have this sense of hope, a sense of optimism, and have faith. And people would say to me, my mother would say over and over again, work hard. And sometime working in the field, I would say to my mother, this is hard work, and this work is about to kill me. Mm-hmm. And she would say, boy, hard work never killed anybody. So I worked very, very hard as a child. But one day in 1955, at the age of 15, I heard of Rosa Parks. Mm-hmm. I heard the words of Martin Luther King Jr. on the radio, and he was talking and preaching about nonviolence, about peace, about reconciliation, about the capacity, the ability to change things. And
he was a preacher.
He was too. A preacher. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be a preacher mm-hmm. as a young child. And I had this sense that if I had faith in my own capacity and ability to get things done, I too could change things. Mm-hmm. So I just never gave up. I never gave in. I just tried to hold on. And so when I went away at the age of 17...
Wait, I want to stay with 14 and 15 just for a minute, because I've read both of your books these last few days. I actually have a 14-year-old son who's here with me on this pilgrimage. And it was so striking to read about you being 14 in 1954 and reading about Brown versus Board of Education. And also, as I read it, being filled with hope and excitement at that news, and also not seeing anything change immediately in the world of Alabama. And really those years of you were 14 and heading into 15, as you say, 1955, you heard Martin Luther King's voice for the first time, the bus boycott, and also things like another 14-year-old boy, Emmett Till, who was killed in Mississippi. So talk a little bit about how that period in your life, which in any life is a tumultuous moment, you know, what started to happen to you then?
During that period, I raised a lot of questions. I asked a lot of questions of my mother, my father, of the ministers around. They accused me of being nosy, and I thought of myself as just wanting to know. Mm-hmm. I was inquisitive. Mm-hmm. When I heard about the Supreme Court decision in 1954, I thought the next school year that I would go to a better school. At least it would be a desegregated school. I wouldn't have to ride a broken-down bus, and I would be able to get new books. But it never happened for me. It never happened. But I didn't give up. I didn't become bitter or hostile. I kept the faith. And I remember hearing about what happened to Emmett Till. And I thought, if something like this can happen to a young man.
This is a young man who was visiting relatives in Mississippi from Chicago, right?
Yes. Yeah. And it could happen to any of us. Mm-hmm. And I remember even before then, in 1951, when I was 11 years old, I traveled one summer with an uncle and aunt and some of my first cousins from rural Alabama to Buffalo for a trip. I had never been outside of the South. And being there gave me hope. And I saw how people lived there. I said, the way they're living in Buffalo, maybe somehow in some way we can make the South, make our region. I wanted to believe, and I did believe, that things would get better. But later I discovered, I guess, that you have to have this sense of faith that what you're moving toward, that is already done.
Say some more about that.
It's the power to believe that you can see, that you can visualize that sense of community, that sense of family, that sense of one house.
And live as if?
And you live that you're already there, mm-hmm. that you're already in that community, part of that sense of one family, mm-hmm. one house. If you visualize it, mm-hmm. If you can even have faith that it's there for you, it is already there. And during the early days of the movement, I believe that the only true and real integration of that sense of the beloved community existed within the movement itself.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the final analysis, we did become a circle of trust, a band of brothers and sisters. So it didn't matter whether we were black or white. It didn't matter whether you came from the north to the south, or whether you're a northerner or southerner. We were one.
You had made that vision real.
For the struggle.
Yes.
For those of us in the struggle. But we studied. We prepared ourselves.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
They descended on the city, tried to send Marines inside. The people fought with rockets and wouldn't make it out alive. They heard what they'd done in Baghdad. They heard how they shot to kill. They heard the news from other cities, how the hospitals were filled. They heard from Samara how they come from all around. They formed a wall around them, how the snipers shot them down. How they sent the population fleeing for their lives. How they swept the streets for prisoners. How they cut the water lines. People knew that it was coming. It was written. City braced for murder with the army moving in. Folks rushed in with medicine, tried to get supplies. Sleepless nights were spent in wonder of who would not survive. They started getting ready as day was coming close. Mujahideen fighters took up corner posts. Some fled for other cities, the rest dug in tight. The farmers of Fallujah would not get down without a fight. November 8th, the troops came pouring in. Bombs ripped apart the houses, people fought them from within. There were cluster bombs exploding, there was phosphorus gas. They were torturing their prisoners, flames were spreading fast. You couldn't walk the streets at night, a curfew was imposed. They ordered evacuations and they blocked the major roads. They were occupying houses, holding families under siege. Shooting from their windows, not letting people leave. Bombing indiscriminately, there were B-52s. They were picking off civilians, there were snipers on the roofs. They were shooting ambulances, there were bodies in the streets. There's 250,000 refugees and 100,000 people who fled have not returned. The air still thick with the smell of people's bodies left to burn. A quarter of the city blown apart by bombs. Now they're sorting through the rubble, picking up the crumbs. That was Fallujah, that was 2004. Soon Tal Afar would fall victim to the war. 3 years of slaughter, no plans to cease. The line of pockets of some people back in Washington, D.C. And it was just like Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. They firebombed Dresden, how it spread from house to house. Paving through the neighborhoods, just like Jenin. Giving contracts to Halliburton, just like New Orleans.
Well, this is something else I want to talk about. The study, the preparation, the discipline. I think the term nonviolent resistance in the 21st century is a term everyone has heard. But reading about how you practiced that, how you learned it, there were small things like maintaining eye contact, you know, wearing coats and ties and dresses, no slouching, no talking, being friendly and courteous. But there was also really serious role-playing. You made a comment. We are meeting each other in the context of a pilgrimage, retracing many places in the civil rights movement with members of Congress and others, which you've helped begin, which is an incredible thing. And yesterday in one of these meetings, you made a comment which was humorous and serious at once, I think, that it would be good for Congress to take up some of the kind of role-playing that you did in the 1950s, 1960s, in the civil rights movement. So would you tell us a little bit about that? What you all did to prepare possibly to be beaten, to be imprisoned, possibly to be killed?
Well, long before any sit-in, any march, long before the Freedom Ride, or the march from Selma to Montgomery, any organized campaign that took place, we did study. I remember as a student in Nashville, Tennessee, a small group of students, every Tuesday night at 6:30 p.m., we gather at a small Methodist church near Fisk University in downtown Nashville. And we had a teacher by the name of Jim Lawson, a young man who taught us the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence. We studied what Gandhi attempted to do in South Africa, what he accomplished in India. We studied Thoreau and civil disobedience. We studied the great religions of the world. And before we even discussed the possibility of a sit-in, we had role playing. We had what we call social drama.
Okay.
And we would act out. That would be black and white young people, students, an interracial group playing the roles of African American. I'd be an interracial group playing the roles of white. And we went through the motion of someone harassing you, calling out of your name, pulling you out of your seat, pulling your chair from under you, someone kicking you, or pretending to spit on you. Sometimes we did pour cold water on someone, never hot. But we went through the motion. This was drama because we wanted people to feel like they were in the actual situation, that this could happen. And we would tell people, for the young men or young women, that if you've been beaten, try to protect the most sensitive part of your body. Roll up, cover your head, and look out for each other. So when the time came, we were ready. We were prepared.
I also read somewhere that you were trained, even if someone was attacking you, to look them in the eye, that there was something disarming for human beings.
We did go through the motion, the drama of saying that if someone kick you, spit on you, pull you off the lunch kind of stool, continue to make eye contact.
Mm-hmm.
Continue to give the impression, yes, you may beat me, but I'm human. Be friendly, try to smile, and just stay nonviolent. Mm-hmm. And during the nonviolent campaigns in a city like Nashville and so many other parts of the American South, you never had one incident of someone striking back or hitting back. Mm-hmm. There were even people who would say, I cannot go on a sit-in. I cannot go on a freedom ride. I may not be disciplined enough. But we were trained. When we left to go on a freedom ride, we were prepared to die for what we believed in.
And the way I come to understand this, as I again study you, is the point of all of this role-playing was not just about being practically prepared. And, you know, I suspect that some neuroscientist now in the 21st century probably understands what happens in our brains somehow with what you knew about that moment of eye contact and human connection. But you also understood this to be a spiritual confrontation, first within yourselves and then with the world outside. Is that right?
You're so right. First of all, you have to grow. It's just not something that is natural.
You
have to be taught the way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence. And in the religious sense, in the moral sense, you can say in the bosom of every human being, there is a spark of the divine. So you don't have a right as a human to abuse that spark of the divine in your fellow human being. We, from time to time, would discuss, if you see someone that attacking you, beating you, spitting on you, you have to think of that person. You know, years ago, that person was an innocent child, innocent little baby.
Mm.
And so what happened? Did something go wrong? Did the environment? Or did someone teach that person to hate, to abuse others? So you try to appeal to the goodness of every human being. And you don't give up. You never give up on anyone.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today in Montgomery, Alabama, with Congressman and civil rights legend John Lewis. On March 7, 1965, John Lewis led a peaceful march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma and was one of the first to be beaten unconscious by police. That day became infamous as Bloody Sunday. So here's a line from your book, Across That Bridge. The civil rights movement, above all, was a work of love. Yet even 50 years later, it is rare to find anyone who would use the word love to describe what we did. What you just said to me illuminates that. I think part of the explanation of that is the way you are using the word love is very rich and multi-layered and also challenging for the person who loves.
Well, I think in our culture, I think sometimes people are afraid to say, I love you. We're afraid to say, especially in public life, many elected officials or would-be elected officials, they're afraid to talk about love. Maybe people tend to think something is so emotional about it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's a sign of weakness. And we're not supposed to cry. We're supposed to be strong. But love is strong. Love is powerful. The movement created what I like to call a nonviolent revolution. It was love at its best.
Mm.
It's one of the highest forms of love. That you beat me, you arrest me, you take me to jail, you almost kill me. But in spite of that, I'm going to still love you. I know Dr. King used to joke sometimes and say things like, just love the hell out of everybody. Just love them.
Love the hell out of them. Yeah.
President Gerald Ford announces the pardon of Richard M. Nixon in 1974.
I have learned already in this office that the difficult decisions always come to this desk. I must admit that many of them do not look at all the same as the hypothetical questions that I have answered freely and perhaps too fast on previous occasions. I deeply believe in equal justice for all Americans, whatever their station or former station. The law, whether human or divine, is no respecter of persons, but the law is a respecter of reality. The facts, as I see them, are that a former president of the United States, instead of enjoying equal treatment with any other citizen accused of violating the law, would be cruelly and excessively penalized, either in preserving the presumption of his innocence or in obtaining a speedy determination of his guilt in order to repay a legal debt to society. During this long period of delay and potential litigation, ugly passions would again be aroused, and our people would again be polarized in their opinions. And the credibility of our free institutions of government would again be challenged at home and abroad. In the end, the courts might well hold that Richard Nixon had been denied due process, and the verdict of history would even more be inconclusive with respect to those charges arising out of the period of his presidency, of which I am presently aware. But it is not the ultimate fate of Richard Nixon that most concerns me, though surely it deeply troubles every decent and every compassionate person. My concern is the immediate future of this great country. In this, I dare not depend upon my personal sympathy as a longtime friend of the former president, nor my professional judgment as a lawyer, and I do not. As president, my primary concern must always be the greatest good of all the people of the United States, whose servant I am. As a man, my first consideration is to be true to my own convictions and my own conscience. My conscience tells me clearly and certainly that I cannot prolong the bad dreams that continue to reopen a chapter that is closed. My conscience tells me that only I, as president, have the constitutional power to firmly shut and seal this book. My conscience tells me it is my duty not merely to proclaim domestic tranquility, but to use every means that I have to ensure it. I do believe that the buck stops here, that I cannot rely upon public opinion polls to tell me what is right. I do believe that right makes might, and that if I am wrong, 10 angels swearing I was right would make no difference. I do believe with all my heart and mind and spirit that I, not as president, but as a humble servant of God, will receive justice without mercy if I fail to show mercy. finally, I feel that Richard Nixon and his loved ones have suffered enough and will continue to suffer no matter what I do, no matter what we as a great and good nation can do together to make his goal of peace come true. Now, therefore, I, Gerald R. Ford, President of the United States, pursuant to the pardon power conferred upon me by Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, have granted, and by these presents do grant, a full, free, and absolute pardon unto Richard Nixon for all offenses against the United States which he, Richard Nixon, has committed or may have committed or taken part in during the period from July 20, 1969 through August 9, 1974.
And now for something completely different.